Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, More Than Meets the Eye, we bring you our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel reading prepared by Jill Bevilacqua, the man who cared about slaves. We shine the spotlight on the figure of St. Peter Claver, the 17th century priest who dedicated his life to evangelizing African slaves brought to Colombia and advocating for their rights. And the cross at the Colosseum. Find out how Rome's ancient amphitheater that was used for bloody gladiatorial contests was reconsecrated as a Christian monument by a past pope. As usual, we begin today's broadcast with Jill Bevilacqua's programme, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus said to his disciples, If your brother should commit some wrong against you, go and point out his fault, but keep it between the two of you. If he listens to you, you have won your brother over. If he does not listen, however, summon another so that every case may stand on the word of two or three witnesses. If he ignores them, refer it to the church. If he ignores even the church, then treat him as you would a Gentile or a tax collector. I assure you, whatever you declare bound on earth shall be held bound in heaven, and whatever you declare loosed on earth shall be held loosed in heaven. Again I tell you, if two of you join your voices on earth to pray for anything, whatever, it shall be granted you by my Father in heaven. Where two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in their midst.
This gospel is chiefly concerned with what's described as brotherly correction, and Matthew is at great pains to explain how we should go about this. As a present-day scholar writes,
when one of these disciples loses his way by taking the wrong road, the community must be like the divine shepherd who goes in search of the lost sheep. Matthew offers an actual rule for the recovery of these brothers in crisis. It was perhaps standard practice in his church and comprised three acts or stages in brotherly correction. First of all, there's personal contact. Then comes the support of other brothers. And finally, there's the whole ecclesia or Christian assembly or congregation who seek to bring the brother or sister to the fullness of communion. This communion is broken if the sinner remains stubborn, and in this case, the church has the power of binding and loosing, that is, of judging or condemning and pardoning. Of course, the hoped-for goal is that of pardon, which must always be sought for as the final solution.
It's always interesting to compare our modern translations of the scriptures with those in use previously. Even the titles given to the different chapters are revealing of the mentality of the time. Instead of brotherly correction, my old New Testament has to denounce to the church incorrigible sinners and to look upon such as refuse to hear the church as heathens. One can almost hear the righteous crying out, "Let him be anathema." The opening words of this gospel, however, are different even in the modern versions. Instead of, "If your brother should commit some wrong against you," the Jerusalem Bible has simply, "If your brother does something wrong." And instead of, "Point out his fault," we have the colloquial, "Have it out with him." But of three modern versions, none has the strong verb used in the old translation, "Rebuke him." How much more careful we've become of other people's feelings, at least in our precepts. In the book of Leviticus, we read,
You must not bear hatred for your brother in your heart. You must openly tell him, your neighbor, of his offense. This way you will not take a sin upon yourself.
Whereas in Ecclesiasticus we have this surprising statement.
Question your friend. He may have done nothing at all, and if he has done anything, he will not do it again.
St. Paul, in his letter to the Thessalonians, advised his followers.
If anyone refuses to obey what I have written in this letter, take note of him and have nothing to do with him, so that he will feel that he is in the wrong, though you are not to regard him as an enemy, but as a brother in need of correction.
And there's a significant warning in his letter to the Galatians when he says,
if any one of you misbehaves, the more spiritual of you who set him right should do so in a spirit of gentleness, not forgetting that you may be tempted yourselves.
While James concludes his letter with these words.
My brothers, if one of you strays away from the truth and another brings him back to it, he may be sure that anyone who can bring back a sinner from the wrong way that he has taken will be saving a soul from death and covering up a great number of sins.
Another important point in this treatment of the erring individual is the reference to two or three witnesses. This is a practice the Jews had, and, comments our modern scholar, suggests that the early Christian communities were not very different from the Jewish ones. Our Lord himself, we read in John, referred to this when the Pharisees told him that his testimony was not valid because he was testifying on his own behalf. In your law, he said, it is written that the testimony of two witnesses is valid. Back in Deuteronomy, we read,
a single witness cannot suffice to convict a man of a crime or offence of any kind. Whatever the misdemeanour, the evidence of two witnesses or three is required to sustain the charge.
And St. Paul quotes these very words in his second letter to the Corinthians. While in the letter to the Hebrews, there's a pretty horrific reminder of the ancient ways.
Anyone who disregards the law of Moses is ruthlessly put to death on the word of two witnesses or three.
One's mind goes immediately to the woman caught in adultery. And at this point, it seems apt to quote a famous example of brotherly correction. Doubly significant because it took place between two brothers. In this letter, Bernard of Clairvaux is writing to the abbot of Trois-Fontaines.
I will tell you about something that once happened to me. It was when my brother Bartholomew was still alive. One day, he displeased me, trembling with rage, and using a threatening expression and tone of voice, I ordered him to leave the monastery. He immediately walked out, went to one of our barns, and stayed there. When I learned of this, I wanted to call him back, but he stated his conditions. He would only return if he were received in his own rank, not in the last rank and as a fugitive, but as if he'd been sent away lightly and without just cause. He maintained that he should not have to submit to due process of the rule for his return, since proper procedures had not been observed in his dismissal. Distrusting my own judgment of this response and of my own actions, and because of the ties of blood between him and me, I entrusted the decision of this affair to the hands of all the brethren. Thus, they judged, in my absence, that his return should not be subject to the letter of the rule, since it was certain that his dismissal had not been conducted in a regular fashion.
This text was taken from one of the exhortations to forgiveness contained in Bernard's correspondence. Now, for the layperson, and even more so for those outside the church, the idea of grown men and women accusing each other of wrongdoing and being subjected to public penance seems to belong to the Middle Ages. But in religious life, to a certain extent, it is still common. But indeed, it goes back even further than the Middle Ages. In his rule, St. Benedict instructed the abbot,
let him be prudent in his correction, lest while he strive to scour off the rust, he break the vessel.
And St. Francis of Assisi, in his admonitions, has these words under the title True Correction.
Blessed that religious who takes blame, accusation, or punishment from another as patiently as if it were coming from himself.
In her biography of Merton, Monica Furlong writes in detail on the subject of faults and their correction.
A regular feature of life at Gethsemane, as at most monastic houses of this period, was the chapter of faults. Its frequency depended on the wishes of the abbot, but it was within the regulations to hold it every day except Sundays and holy days. At the invitation of the abbot, monks came forward, bowed low, and accused themselves of faults in carrying out the rule. Others also were invited to proclaim the faults of the individual with the words, "I proclaim Father X," and going on to state the faults he had noticed. It is to be regarded as a fault to excuse oneself, even though we are not guilty. The superior imposed penances for faults, varying from light to grave. For a light fault, the monk might take his meals after the rest of the community and be deprived of any duty in choir. At each office, he would prostrate himself on the presbytery step, or he might have to accuse himself in the refectory, or read some relevant portion of a pious book aloud, or say a prayer, perhaps with his arms extended in the form of a cross. Or he might eat at a small stool in the middle of the refectory instead of at table, or be instructed to prostrate himself at the door of the refectory, so that everyone who entered had to step over him, or have to kiss the feet of the whole community, bowing to them two at a time between the exertion. All these practices had in common, and had been in common in medieval times, and had been hallowed by unbroken tradition since. The total stylization of punishment of faults, in a sense, robbed it of some of the pain. Everyone partook of the experience, and always in the same way. Yet it was without doubt humiliating, and intended to be so. Writing of Mother Birchman's, Merton describes with feeling the postulant who would fall on her knees and accuse herself of dissipation, or read in a loud, clear voice St. Benedict's ninth and tenth degrees of humility concerning monks who talk too much or laugh too much. The rule is careful to demand of novices, he says, that they be zealous for humiliations.
And now, before turning to the last part of our gospel, here's a light-hearted poem I came across in an anthology of 20th-century verse. It's by John Mead Faulkner, and is called After Trinity. It could be relevant for any Sunday at this time of the year. It matters little that the writer has counted only 25 Sundays.
We have done with dogma and divinity, Easter and Whitsun past. The long, long Sundays after Trinity are with us at last. The passionless Sundays after Trinity, neither feast day nor fast. Christmas comes with plenty, Lent spreads out its pall, but these are 25, the longest Sundays of all. The placid Sundays after Trinity, wheat harvest, fruit harvest, fall. Spring, with its burst, is over. Summer has had its day. The scented grasses and clover are cut and dried into hay. The singing birds are silent, and the swallows flown away. Post puniam pausa fiat, Lord, we have made our choice. In the stillness of autumn quiet, we have heard the still small voice. We have sung, O where shall wisdom, thick paper, folio, voice. Let it not all be sadness, not omnia vanitas. Stir up a little gladness to lighten the tibi crass. Send us that little summer that comes with Martinmas. When still the cloudlit dapples the windless cobalt blue, and the scent of gathered apples fills all the storerooms through, the gossamer silvers the bramble, the lawns are gemmed with dew.
The last part of our gospel is very familiar, and where there's a shortage of priests, the words of our Lord cannot but be an encouragement to lay people to join together in prayer, as they always have done. And since the Vatican Council, there's been a flowering of so-called prayer meetings. Where two or three are gathered together, there am I in the midst of them. But the opposite also happens, and there are many churches in the Western world where there's no longer a congregation. Churches like this have been closed, destroyed, in some cases converted into dwellings or adapted for public use. But in a fanciful poem by Rudyard Kipling, we're transported back into the Dark Ages, when a priest refuses to close his church and celebrates a midnight mass for such as care to attend.
Eddie, priest of St. Wilfrid, in the chapel at Manhood End, ordered a midnight service for such as cared to attend. But the Saxons were keeping Christmas, and the night was stormy as well. Nobody came to service, though Eddie rang the bell. "Wicked weather for walking," said Eddie of Manhood End, "but I must go on with the service for such as care to attend." The altar candles were lighted. An old marsh donkey came, bold as a guest invited, and stared at the guttering flame. The storm beat on at the windows, the water splashed on the floor, and a wet, yoke-weary bullock pushed in through the open door. How do I know what is greatest? How do I know what is least? "That is my father's business," said Eddie, Wilfrid's priest. "But three are gathered together. Listen to me and attend. I bring good news, my brethren," said Eddie of Manhood End. And he told the ox of a manger and a stall in Bethlehem, and he spoke to the ass of a rider that rode to Jerusalem. They steamed and dripped in the chancel. They listened and never stirred, while just as though they were bishops, Eddie preached them the word. Till the gale blew off on the marshes, and the windows showed the day, and the ox and the ass together wheeled and clattered away. And when the Saxons mocked him, said Eddie of Manhood End, "I dare not shut his chapel on such as care to attend."
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that programme. Among Pope Francis's engagements during his pastoral journey to Colombia was a visit on Sunday to the shrine of the 17th century Jesuit priest St. Peter Claver and to the church named after him, located in the city of Cartagena. But who exactly was St. Peter Claver? And why did he become the patron saint of Colombia and of slaves? Originally from Spain, Claver came over to Colombia in 1610 and dedicated nearly 40 years of his life ministering to the slaves who were brought from Africa to the port of Cartagena after a voyage where nearly half of them perished due to the appalling conditions in the hold of the ships. On arrival in Cartagena, the slaves were sold and sent to work in the mines or on the plantations, where they usually endured extremely harsh and cruel conditions. Claver helped care for the sick and dying among the slaves, and it's estimated that he personally baptized around 300,000 Africans. He was constantly urging the plantation owners to treat the slaves more humanely, and was a tireless campaigner for the abolition of the African slave trade. Pope Francis's visit to Colombia coincided with the feast day of this saint, who was seen as a trailblazer in view of his passionate concern about the human rights of these African slaves. Grant Jones is the executive director of the Knights of St. Peter Claver, based in New Orleans, which is a predominantly African-American lay Catholic organization. He told me more about the figure of St. Peter Claver and why his ministry was so heroic.
St. Peter Claver, who was from Spain, you know, became a Jesuit priest. And when he was in Cartagena or in South America, he viewed the slave ships coming from Africa as that was a landing point, you know, for slaves coming from Africa. And viewing the conditions that they were being treated, he was inspired to help them, and then later devote his entire life to basically serving the enslaved or the people who were treated unjustly. So, you know, that was his motivation for dedicating his life to his cause.
Can you tell me something about how horrific exactly were the conditions in the hold of these slave ships that brought these men, women, and children over from Africa?
Well, essentially, the slaves were in the holds of the ships almost stacked up like cordwood, you know, side by side, maybe with 5 or 6 inches above the person on top of them, essentially almost like cattle. There was no air circulation. People became ill. You know, they're just in their own bodily fluids and just horrific. And a large percentage, you know, estimates as many as 50% actually perished on the journey from Africa to this hemisphere.
St. Peter Claver was a trailblazer, wasn't he, when it came to caring passionately about human rights at a time in a history when presumably most people viewed these African slaves as barely human, would it be fair to say?
Yes, that is fair to say. But him seeing the human spirit in these poor and fortunate people that were being treated this way, you know, he ministered to them their physical needs, nursing them back to health, but then also in the process, he exposed them to Catholicism and to Christianity, and it is said that during his mission that he actually Christianized, is the word that we use, over 300,000 Africans during that period of time, actually bringing Africans into the Catholic faith.
What do you find particularly heroic and inspirational about St. Peter Claver's ministry?
Well, what was heroic about it is the fact that he came from well-to-do noble parents of Spain, and he could have had any cushy assignment within the church, but he actually chose to come to that area. And then also it was at a time where he could be shunned, and actually was shunned by the rest of society for his engagement with the African slaves. So in other words, you know, he went against the grain and bore personal sacrifice to his reputation to a certain extent to help the underprivileged.
How would you evaluate the impact of Pope Francis's trip to Colombia, during which he's visiting St. Peter Claver's shrine and the church named after him? Do you believe this papal visit will help to give a higher profile to the figure of this saint?
Absolutely. As a member of the Knights of Peter Claver, named after St. Peter Claver, a lot of times, even within the Catholic community, I'll be asked, well, who is Peter Claver? I've never heard of him. And of course, we have to give the same information I'm giving to you. And we actually have little prayer cards that we hand out that give a little information on St. Peter Claver. So just with the Pope's popularity and him being kind of a populist type Pope, which is really focusing on serving the members of the church as opposed to a more hierarchical type pontificate that he's had, yes, certainly his focus on the underprivileged and the needy will do two things. It will shed light on the conditions that exist in that country, but then also that patron saint. So I certainly 100% agree that his visit will enlighten the world on St. Peter Claver as far as people's knowledge of him.
How would you sum up St. Peter Claver's legacy in Colombia, but also in the rest of the world?
Well, that's kind of hard to sum up his legacy because a lot of his work is still going on, or the conditions that caused for him to start his ministry still continues. But to answer your question more directly, those in South America, particularly in Cartagena, and we actually have members that are on San Andres Island off the coast of Bogota there, St. Peter Claver is certainly well known to them because they were directly impacted by his ministry. So his legacy is basically a patron saint to the enslaved or the underserved. So that's what he's known for. So anyone who is knowledgeable about St. Peter Claver, when they hear his name, they think about someone who served the underprivileged and the enslaved.
And why was it decided to set up the Knights of St. Peter Claver? And if you could sum up briefly, what is your mission?
Well, our mission is to basically continue service to the church and service to mankind. Our organization was founded in 1909 by a group of Catholic Josephite priests and three laymen, basically for the purpose of forming a Catholic fraternal organization for men. as a means of keeping men in the Catholic faith, particularly men of color, in the Catholic faith at that time. In 1909 in the United States, that was during a period of time of segregation, and African Americans were not, or people of color in general, were not allowed to join other Catholic fraternal organizations. So the priests, Josephites, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with their mission. Their mission is essentially along the same lines of St. Peter Claver. They serve African American and Indian parishes as their vocation, and they saw a need for this in our community, so they assisted us in forming our own fraternal organization. So, you know, we help support different charitable causes. We support the parish priests and the parishes in which we have units, and that's our whole mission, is to serve the church and to serve mankind in tangible ways as well.
I was speaking there to Grant Jones, Executive Director of the Knights of St. Peter Claver organization. Finally, when most people think about Rome, there are arguably two buildings that are seen as the most iconic symbols of the Eternal City and its long and tumultuous history. One is St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican, and the other is the ancient Roman amphitheatre, the Colosseum, that was used for many centuries for bloodthirsty gladiatorial contests. Let's now join our popular Latin lover, Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's former Latinist, who went to the Colosseum in the company of Veronica Scaresbrick. Father Foster told Veronica how the ancient amphitheatre was reborn and Christianized by Pope Pius IX in 1852.
Father, I can see there's a cross just opposite the Colosseum here. Why is there a cross on what could be a pagan amphitheatre?
Well, yeah, I can see the Latin inscription here says this is Pius IX, a very nice thing in 1852. Yeah, that's right. He says this amphitheater dedicated to the gods by impious religion, and he says, and reborn from this bad superstition by the blood of the martyrs. And so the idea was with the Christians, they still thought that there were these masses of Christian martyrs here who reconsecrated the Colosseum to the true God after it had been used for false gods for so many centuries. So that's written all in Latin. If people understand Latin, you're going to understand. I can read this from here. In the fourth line, it says it was reborn by the blood of the martyrs. So kind of transferred. So the Christians came along and said, okay, this is our place now. There were two churches, two chapels in the Colosseum dedicated to the martyrs. All that stuff was torn out. As I say, Philip Neri set up a Station of the Cross inside. So this goes way back to the 1500s, the tradition of the Station of the Cross in the Colosseum.
You mentioned earlier that it was what happened here was a disgrace.
Well, yeah, because the Romans were very crude, you know. I mean, I love Latin, it's my whole life. I mean, their culture was very crude. The Greeks had, you know, the fine games, you know, the Olympic games. What the Romans thought was pleasurable, I mean, the more blood and the more horror went on, the more the people were delighted.
And that was the Pope's former Latinist, Father Reginald Foster, speaking to Veronica Scaresbrick. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.